From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll dig into the ongoing scandals at the Massachusetts State Police. That's in our week in review. Also today, the sometimes blurred lines of sex, comfort, and power in art following the resignation from Mass Art of photographer Nicholas Nixon.
I have to get them to give as much feeling and sometimes as much nakedness as they're willing to give in a short time. And I have to have them feel good about it.
And Richard Powers on his new novel, The Overstory, an ode to the natural world and its ability to maybe save us from ourselves.
The great majority of us are suffering from what psychologists call species loneliness. Not loneliness for other human beings. We're lonely because we've talked ourselves into believing we're the only game in town. We're the only interesting thing going on.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. It's Friday afternoon. Time for our week in review, starting with the ongoing problems at the Massachusetts State Police. New reports this week that the agency failed to disclose significant overtime pay to members of what's called Troop F, and a payroll director is charged with stealing some $24,000 from the agency. Here's Governor Charlie Baker responding to the charges against the payroll director on Wednesday.
This is good news, folks. When the leadership of the state police is cleaning up its own house and doing the investigation that develops a baseline for a criminal investigation, that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
The governor and the new state police colonel, Kerry Gilpin, have repeatedly promised change, especially about overtime pay abuse. And the attorney general's office is looking into possible criminal charges against 21 state troopers in this scandal. AG Maura Healy told us this week she has complete confidence in her office's investigators who are state troopers themselves.
We regularly do investigations and bring action in the space of public integrity. It's something that we do, and I think do well. I have no qualms whatsoever about the investigators and troopers in my office, their ability to carry out investigations and do their job.
Okay, let's dig into this topic and the rest of the week's local news. In the studio, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Welcome. And also with us this week, Richard Desai, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. It's really good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you both for coming in. It's a lot to talk about. According to MassLive, which is the Springfield Daily paper, the Massachusetts State Payroll Director, Denise Ezekiel, allegedly filed 29 fraudulent reimbursements over 15 months. That's to herself. That's before the agency suspended her and launched a criminal investigation. Renee, if I could start with you to your reaction to this latest next tick in an ongoing story about the state police overall.
If there's something about the drip, drip, drip of these stories and what's going on at the state police, I was really struck by the comment that State Police spokesman David Procopio made about there being no connection between the Ezekiel case and everything else that's been going on concerning pay fraud. And I think he said it to be reassuring. It's not reassuring. You know, you don't have the sense that the fire is just contained to the basement. This is out of control and raging through this agency. It's really disconcerting what's going on there.
And Richard, is a former state lawmaker and in state lawmaking, have you ever seen anything like this?
Clearly, there's a problem. I mean, you have overtime abuse, you have hidden pay, lack of transparency, and you have outright theft. And I think it's all ironic that the payroll director is actually, she wasn't a police officer, but she's stealing from the police in the department. It's very brazen. And it obviously, I think, shows that there is an underlying problem there, that this is an agency that hasn't had the oversight that it's needed to allow these. And then there are a whole bunch of other things that have happened there as
long
well.
Long time oversight lacking? I mean, back sometime maybe when you were part of state government or not?
I think that this is built up over a long period of time. And I do think that the Attorney General, it's actually good to have new leadership at the state police with the new colonel and have the attorney general looking into all of these things.
So general confidence in Maura Healy and what in her oversight on this now, her investigation?
At this point, yes. You know, I was also sort of struck by the governor's comment that, you know, the state police sort of cleaning its own house, that this is a good thing. That's a little hasty. Let's not talk about what's a good thing just yet. Let's just see how this all plays out, you know, and if we're going to have the transparency that Richard was just talking about in these investigations.
Well, let's get – go ahead.
I was just going to say, I thought it was good. I think what the governor has done so far on this is good, and I do think that if you listen to him carefully yesterday, he did step right up and say this happened under my watch. It wasn't like
saying it happened under his watch. Well, I don't think he should get credit for that. It did happen under his watch.
But he isn't just sitting there. He's working with the leadership right now at the State Police Department to put in the reforms that are needed and to, again, do the things that need to be done to put this agency back on track.
But given that these stories keep coming, I think it's a little premature to be saying this is good news, folks, that the state police is getting
its
house in order.
Do you think he owns this? Does he really own this the way he said yesterday? Does he own the scandal?
I think he has no choice.
I think that in the case of the hidden pay, that's been going on for many, many, many years. Obviously, this overtime situation, which is thievery, has been going on for a long time as well. And again, it's a culture, I think, issue. And you have a new colonel that the governor's appointed in place, who's obviously very serious about bringing upon the reforms that are needed within that department.
So there's a lot of watchers in this case. The Boston Herald had Gus Bickford yesterday, chairman of the state's Democratic Party. He said, quote, when senior command staff at the scandal-ridden state police are given a way out through retirement in the wake of serious allegations, and the governor turns around and says, it's a good thing. This is back to what you were saying earlier. When charges are brought against a middle manager in the payroll department, it's time for an independent investigation. Maura Healey, not enough. Is there more investigation needed to this state matter?
Well, I think as it keeps building and building, I think the more investigations, the better. I don't have a problem with an independent investigator coming in at this point. That's not to say that I have a lack of confidence in what Maura Healey will do, but I also think that it seems like every single day, every single week, there's another story coming out of the state police, and they need to get to the bottom of this.
Okay, so I got one more for you. As you know, as we've been talking about in getting to this point, coming out this week is the reporting in the Globe on per diem payments in figures recently released. State officials revealed that more than $3.4 million, that's additional payouts over 4 years for these Troop F employees. They're getting $40 a day, for instance, for driving their own cars to work. I want to hear from the governor right now. This was Governor Baker on Wednesday responding to the ideas that this has been in place for a long time as part of union negotiated perks.
The elements associated with that, I think, have been in place since the 70s. And I don't know what else was part of that. What I can tell you is that there are a whole series of pretty big and significant issues around reform at the state police that are going to be part of the bargaining negotiation.
So this is another money matter, but it's a union matter. Do unions play the role in this? How does this differ to you? Does it feel does it smell funny?
Of course it smells funny. $40 a day, it feels like the state police was operating as an ATM. There was just endless amounts of money that people can earn in sort of bogus overtime and now per diems. And it has the sense that this is out of control. This isn't just one small area of the state police that needs to be dealt with. It seems like there's much more systemic problem.
Detail work has been always, called out. So yeah.
This isn't your typical state agency or department either. It's the state police. And I think it's really important for people to have confidence in the state police and in the administration of the department. So I do think, this should be at the very top. We're looking at the FBI right now falling apart. Obviously, on the state level, the state police. You really need to make sure that the public has confidence.
All right. I know that we could talk longer about matters of the state. I want to get to some city issues, municipal policing. One specifically in Cambridge, and it taps into a lot of what's going on in our culture right now. The Cambridge Police Department this week said it will conduct an internal interview following a forceful arrest of a black Harvard University student over the weekend. His name is Salerm O'Heen. He's 21 years old. I believe he's a mathematics major, and he was, by all accounts on video, forcefully arrested Friday night after walking naked on Massachusetts Avenue near Cambridge Common. There is a video out released by Cambridge Police where officers are seen, and some bystanders, officers are seen tackling the man, and at least one officer hits him as he's being arrested, and the bystanders are shouting repeatedly, "Don't hurt him." This is Cambridge Police Commissioner Branville G. Bard Monday saying he supports the officers. Their actions should be judged in the context of that night.
I just want to stress here also that it's important to not gauge the officer's actions within the construct of some ideal construct. and to actually gauge their actions within the context of a rapidly evolving situation. To do so, like with 2020 hindsight, is unfair. The officers took the actions that they felt necessary at that time.
And the Harvard Black Law Students Association says otherwise. They called the incident a brutal instance of police violence. And this is member Emmanuel Powell. He told us on Radio Boston this week that it should not have been the police who even responded to the call in the first place.
The options where you have medical professionals who are trained to de-escalate and are not people coming with guns or who have been trained on a force continuum for how to operate, but know how to de-escalate a situation.
I know, Renee, that you wrote in the Globe this week about the arrest of two black men in Philadelphia at the Starbucks. What is your take on this situation in Cambridge over this week?
Well, look, I think in both instances, we're only talking about these things because they were caught on videotape. You know, these incidents aren't new. The difference is the technology that's now recording these things happening. You know, I think the thing in Cambridge, when you watch the videotape, what you see is a man who's down. There are officers have him pinned to the ground, and then another officer starts to hit him. I think the questions have to be asked. Why are they hitting him? You know, I understand where the Cambridge police chief is coming from. He has to protect his officers and say what's necessary to protect them. But look at the videotape. Talk to the witnesses. What happened there? Why is a man pinned to the ground and still being, you know, assaulted? And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that the gentleman who you just played made the comment, de-escalation. Are officers properly taught how to de-escalate situations?
Right. Do you think it's this is a young Harvard student named, I just lost his name, Emmanuel Powell. Is he calling the police out, saying that when they responded, there may have not been a medical assistance with them. They may not have been trained or may have been trained in de-escalation, but there was no medical assistance. This man may have, we don't know what was going on with this man, that he was walking naked down Mass Ave.
Right. Well, he was walking naked. We know this much. He didn't have a weapon.
We know this much.
Okay. So, you know, we don't know if he was on drugs or whatever the situation was with that. But again, there was no example in that videotape of any attempt by the police to de-escalate that situation beyond hitting him.
Richard, is there also something, and I ask this to you, Renee, as well, that this was in Harvard, that we're hearing about this, not only because everybody has an iPhone or some kind of camera with a phone with a camera. It's Harvard we're talking about.
I think it's, first of all, great that everybody does have a camera right now and you can record these things. So there isn't a lot. I mean, I watched the video, and by watching the video, you definitely form an opinion. And in this case, I do think that the police were probably overly aggressive and overreacted to the situation. But to ascribe the police actions to racism, I think, is a stretch. I don't think it has anything to do with that. There was a guy, you know, standing naked on the corner in the street. Obviously, a number of people said he was under hallucinogenic drugs. And, you know, the police have to be careful to protect themselves. And again, I'm saying that in the context that I do think they overreacted. And I do think that they probably need to be trained better in de-escalation techniques. But I don't see anything in this that, to me, or that even in the situation in Philadelphia, that would point to racism. And I think that people have to be careful when these incidents do pop up, that isn't the first thing that people say. You have, you know, when you go down that path, you have to have some type of supporting.
Renee,
well, I think people have to be honest about the situation. If you had, in the situation in Philadelphia, you had numerous white people who said, well, I've been sitting here for an hour and I haven't ordered anything and no one bothered me. You know, what the videotape shows and what the police record shows is that the police were called 2 minutes after they arrived. What on earth did they do within those 2 minutes to merit a call to the police?
But again, Renee, you don't know what was in the heart of that woman who worked at Starbucks. Is she a racist? Because, you know, you don't know that. And there's nothing in the tape.
Were her actions racist?
When she called up, she said that there were two gentlemen here who won't leave. She didn't say there were two black men.
I want to bring this back to Cambridge.
And I understand, right. But you don't know that. You're taking a leap. And I just think it's bad.
But you're taking a leap as well, assuming that she didn't see two black men not doing anything. If there's all these other people
there. But not everybody sees
Richard,
not
Renee,
everybody
I need
sees
to bring this back to Cambridge
and,
because yeah, we can't yeah. solve involved this in here, but it's a fabulous, it's an important conversation, and I'm not shutting it down. But we need to stick in our city for this minute, because I want to ask a question about the notion of jumping to conclusions, and that's, you know, would we as the public jump to a conclusion that this was a racist incident, implied race bias or not, in Cambridge the other weekend? I mean, are we having to take a breath and say, don't jump to conclusions, but could be? I mean, there is something in there in how we respond as the public, as police, as press.
I think it depends who you are, how you respond.
And it does depend exactly the way you see things. And I just think it's really bad for the country
view everything. What is your experience? I think, what is your experience? You know, I think if you're in a situation where, you know, you're talking about that area, Rittenhouse Square, well, back to Philadelphia, but, you know, people have to ask the question, because of the history of this country, if that Harvard student had been white, would he have been treated the same way?
Well, there was a student, an Asian student, who was arrested some years ago, also naked. I don't remember what year this was, but there was no issue around him being aggressively arrested. That has been out there as well. I believe that was in the Harvard Crimson, reported in the Harvard Crimson this week.
It shouldn't have happened. That's the bottom line. They overreacted. It shouldn't have happened. But to ascribe it, as a racism issue, I think is bad for our society right now.
Okay. And as far as we know, according to reports, only one woman said out loud that this man was on drugs. So we just don't know yet.
Right,
and this is the
know.
Whole point is like that
right.
We have to wait. We do. It's horrible to have this kind of patience when somebody when there looks to be aggression and unfairly so, or it appears to be. We don't know. Let's note that we need to book you both in here to keep this conversation going. It's an important one, and it's the one of this, of this time for sure. Another police story before we head into another topic. Wednesday, a lot of people showed up. Massachusetts officials and law enforcement, especially from across the country, gathered on Cape Cod for the funeral of Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon. He was 32 years old. He was fatally shot last week while trying to serve a warrant on a man with a long list of criminal charges. Thomas Latanowicz has pleaded not guilty to murder and other charges, and he's being held without bail. Speaking after Gannon's funeral this week, Dudley Police Chief Stephen Wayner, is also the president of the Massachusetts Police Chiefs Association, said this to WBUR.
Anytime you do this job, you understand that you could face the same situation that this officer did. So whenever these things happen, I think we can all relate to that. And these things are happening too often. It's an unfortunate reality now that there are segments of society that will almost promote violence towards police, and that's just absolutely wrong.
Later that day, Governor Charlie Baker told reporters he supports the death penalty for those who kill cops.
I've supported the death penalty for people who kill a cop for a long time, and I think there's legislation currently pending before the legislature on that. If it got to my desk, I would sign it.
Richard, if you could help me remember some of this. Back in 1997, the Massachusetts state legislature was just a few votes, maybe one vote away from passing a death penalty law, a bill, that is. Could it happen with present lawmakers? And I ask you both, should it?
I don't think it could happen now. I think that both the House and the Senate have a different membership right now, and I think it would be very difficult to get the votes to do it.
I don't think it could happen. I don't think it should happen. I think you shouldn't have a special category for the death penalty, that this crime merits the death penalty, but that crime does not. I think that's inconsistent. So, I'm not generally a supporter of the death penalty anyway, so I would say no.
It's interesting, though, that you have both of these stories back to back, because this is a perfect example of how dangerous policing is. And, when police officers are in a situation like they were in Cambridge, they're that's one extreme, and then you have the other, and you can see why police have to be so careful right now.
It's funny, I was actually thinking the same thing, but in regards to the fact that the suspect in the shooting of the Yarmouth police officer is alive. He was being arrested for shooting a police officer, and somehow he managed to still be alive and was arrested without incident.
And I have to ask also, were you surprised to hear the governor say this, though? Governor Baker say that he thought for this in the incidents of people killing police, there should be a death penalty.
I think that's been his position for quite some time.
Yeah, I agree. It's not inconsistent for him to say so.
Let's leave this world of law enforcement and the challenges and the various financial scandals behind and move on to the topic of UMass and Mount Ida. we've got controversy going on. Mount Ida in Newton sold to UMass Amherst on Tuesday. Hundreds turned out at UMass Boston to call for the cancellation of the sale. And a quick recap, UMass Amherst is spending $75 million in the deal, angering people at UMass Boston, which has been struggling with its budget and its program and staff cuts. This is Arthur Mabbitt, a chairman emeritus at UMass Boston Board of Visitors, saying the sale will further the inequality on the campuses in the state.
Having competition within the university system should be a no-no. The system should operate as a system. And if Amherst wanted a Boston presence, quite frankly, simply come to UMass Boston and establish some joint programs.
And meanwhile, the state's higher education officials are looking into the abrupt closure and the sale of Mount Ida. This is the Higher Ed Commissioner Carlos Santiago speaking to reporters yesterday, saying his primary concern is what's happening to the students at Mount Ida.
Our goal is for the students to have options. No one campus or one institution has a monopoly on where these students are going to go. We want to make sure not only does the transfer work for these students, their credits count. We want them to graduate as quickly as they can on their original schedules, and we want to make sure the programs are of high quality.
Okay, before we go any further, I have to make a disclaimer, which is that I work at New England Public Radio in Springfield, which is also WFCR, and the license is owned by UMass Amherst, so let's get that out there. And technically, I am an employee of the state. We cover campus stories, and we do that with the same standards as we do with everything. So let's get at it. You know, the UMass system is already divided, right, in many ways. I want to hear from one more person, Katie Matrano. She's the president of the UMass Boston Undergraduate Student Government. She spoke this week in Dorchester on the campus of UMass Boston. This is courtesy of Fox 25 News.
When UMass Boston was and is still suffering, the Board of Trustees, President Meehan, or UMass Amherst did not assist us. However, when a private institution goes under, UMass Amherst bails them out of all of their debts, and those students become, and I quote, a top priority for President Meehan.
All right, so this purchase of Mount Ida by UMass, does this further divide a state system that is already pretty inequitable in on the campus, for the campuses?
Yes.
Of course, right, that is the answer.
Like, but you know how a parent will say they don't choose favorites among their children? Let's just say Marty Meehan has a favorite child, and it's not in Dorchester. You know, obviously, this is all about UMass Amherst. And I just feel like in all of these conversations that have been had, no one's thinking about these students. They're not thinking about the students at UMass Boston, and they're certainly not thinking about the students at Mount Ida.
Nobody's thinking about the students at Mount Ida. It appears that, you know, I mean, that's not true. That's a, I shouldn't have said it like that. But this is where I'm chomping at the bit, and I want to ask you about this, Richard. UMass President Marty Meehan has said it's a move to make Amherst more competitive in the job market. But as a reporter, I'm thinking, but this is a statewide system. Why does West move east? What is allowing that?
The UMass Amherst part of it is sort of very hard to understand when you look at the overall picture. I would say that this is probably the latest and probably one of the first of these colleges that are going to go out of business. I don't think that there's anything that could be done to keep them open. So making sure that the students who are there right now are able to continue on with their education and have opportunities in other schools is obviously really important. And then I would say, secondly, you know, the UMass system in general, you know, you have tuition hikes, you have fee hikes, you have lack of resources, you have you don't have enough capital money right now. So there can be a pretty strong argument to be made, you know, hey, why don't we improve what we have right now before we, you know, add on to the system? And again, the UMass component of it, Amherst.
You know what they say in Amherst, by the way? They say, welcome to Amherst, where only the H is silent. So this is a town thing, by the way. Yeah. But I know of UMass Boston. I also worked there at some point at that radio station. And it's a hard campus. It's physically crumbling at times. It has been. It's a funny thing to watch this. This is a state coffer. So
it just has the sense that there's this house that needs to be repaired, but in the meantime, they're buying this beautiful summer home somewhere. Why isn't this money going to UMass Boston? The idea that, well, we need to have a Boston presence. You have a Boston presence. It's called UMass Boston. Do something with it.
On the other hand, though, I know that the President Meehan's being criticized for this, but this might be something 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the line that people say, you know, sort of like the Louisiana Purchase. You know, very controversial at the time, but great for the
That's a fun example.
Maybe it will be great.
All right, we got to get the two of you.
Be great for the system.
Have to be back in the studio together. There's a lot to talk about, and clearly some great barbing opinions. Thank you both so much for coming. Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Thank you very much. It's really nice to meet you as well. Stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Hitesh Hathi. We're about to talk art, but before we get into it, a warning. The subject is mature and sexually graphic, so please take that into account, especially if you're listening with children. We're talking about the case of Nicholas Nixon. He's the nationally acclaimed photographer who retired from the Massachusetts College of Art and Design last month, shortly before the school publicly announced an investigation into allegations that he acted inappropriately with students. I want to note that when we first aired the story, we said Nixon had resigned. In fact, he had retired, and we've corrected our copy. Our guest host, Jill Kaufman, picks up the story.
Nixon is best known for a series of portraits called The Brown Sisters. They're beautiful. They're of his wife and her three sisters, and they were taken every year since the 1970s. The allegations against Nixon range from sending inappropriate emails to some of his female subjects, to assigning his students to take pictures of people's genitalia, and to critiquing photos of Nixon's own genitals. Some mass art students say those assignments intended to push artistic boundaries, but others say they went right through those boundaries. Here, Nixon talks about his artistic process. This is part of an exhibition at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston.
Photographing the people is hard psychologically. I have to be a kind of Don Juan, but I have to be polite and kind and completely honest and transparent. And so if I'm photographing the pictures of couples, I go into a room with them, and in an hour, I have to get them to give as much feeling and sometimes as much nakedness as they're willing to give in a short time. And I have to have them feel good about it.
That video was up at the ICA. That and the rest of Nixon's ICA exhibition was taken down shortly after the allegations of his inappropriate behavior with students. WBUR arts reporter Maria Garcia is in the studio with us now to look not just at what's happening at Mass Art, but also to explore these ideas of sex and power and education in art. It's good to be with you. And it's been really interesting to learn about this topic with you and your reporting.
Hi, Jill. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The experimental filmmaker Saul Levine also stepped down. That's after complaints from students who watched a film with graphic scenes of him having sex with his partner in class. Can you talk a little bit first about exactly what Nixon and Levine are accused of in a school setting?
Sure, Jill. So a Boston Globe investigation revealed Nixon allegedly asked students to actually analyze pictures of his own penis. He also allegedly assigned his students to photograph at least 10 penises and 10 vaginas, preferably of people they wanted to sleep with and found attractive, and encouraged his students to start with each other. He would also, according to the Globe, ask his undergraduate students to pose partially or fully nude for him. Nixon's lawyer says students posed consensually and signed written agreements with Nixon. And Jill, as for Saul Levine, he says he was pushed out after teaching at Mass Art for 39 years after showing a class his 1989 experimental film called Notes After Long Silence. And that film includes images of him having sex with his then partner. And students complained of having to sit through this film that showed his professor engaging in sexual acts.
So Saul Levine is out because of student complaints, and Nixon and the investigation began after the Boston Globes started hearing about this. Is that accurate?
So the Boston Globe started investigating months ago, and then the university announced last month. Saul Levine says he was pushed out because of the complaints by students.
So in other contexts, these actions would seem, or these assignments would seem rather extraordinary, that a professor showing students images of him having sex. But this I understand is the same is not the same for everyone. Not everyone was surprised. In the name of art, you know, some even expect that these are acceptable ideas of assignments. In the name of art, which is an old phrase.
Right, Jill. So you have to understand that sex is a legitimate subject matter in art education. It's taken very seriously. It's a subject that's canonized and taught in an earnest fashion. We can go back, for example, you know, as early as the 1530s, you know, when Correggio painted Leda seduced by a swan and how radical that was. And even in contemporary art, I mean, you just don't have to dig that deep to find artists constantly pushing sexually subversive subject matter. 1972, for example, this artist named Vito Acconci performed a piece at a gallery in New York called Seedbed, in which he hid behind floorboards at the gallery and he was hooked up to a microphone while he masturbated when gallery visitors walked around the gallery. And that piece has been canonized. You can go to the Met right now in New York City, find a picture of that piece. You know, and the Met describes it as a sort of a seminal work that transformed the gallery space. Robert Mapplethorpe, for example, in 1978, he has a self-portrait that was lionized, very famous now, of himself staring at the camera while he inserts a bullwhip into his anus.
So, Emery, I just want to jump in for a second, because while these may not have been in the school setting, others did call these pieces of art out. I mean, how they were funded, whether it was a foundation or public funding from, you know, the NEA. I mean, these things have not been uncontroversial. It just wasn't at a school, at a college, for instance.
Right, but within the art world, they've been canonized.
Right.
You know, and so they're integral to the art history canon, to the way that schools teach art. So within this context, Saul Levine saw it as sort of a benign act when he showed his video of himself having sex to his students.
We are seeing a policing of the curricula. To put it in the jargon of the left, we're seeing domestic neoliberalism. We're seeing an attack on academic freedom, on the agency of the students. They are being infantilized.
That's Mass Art Professor Saul Levine, former Mass Art Professor. So he's arguing, Maria Garcia, that schools are taking away the agencies of students, that, you know, the ability to make decisions. But wasn't he complaining to administrators about the video also an act of agency? Wasn't the students complaining to the administrators their act of agency?
Yeah, I think it's very arguable that it was. And, you know, art as a discipline has really prided itself on accepting diverging thought. So we have to remember that students as a body are not monolithic. I'm sure there are students who see this as just part of art education. But what's more telling for me, Jill, is that this illustrates that art is not immune to the powers of the world. It is of this world. It is part of the world. And so it mimics hierarchies. It mimics power structures of the world. It's incredibly patriarchal. And historically, men have controlled the narrative, the canonization, the institutions of art. So despite art's sort of esoteric nature, it's not exempt from the ills of the world. It's a trade that lionizes mostly white male egos. It sort of deifies creative geniuses. And some would say it gives them the license to abuse.
There is so much to unpack here, and we're not going to have time in the next minute, but I do want to bring this back to mass art and look at the something that is an ethical question that many people are saying, that an art professor in the classroom asking his undergraduate students to pose nude for him clearly crosses a line. What are we hearing about that?
Well, look, it goes back to the power dynamics of art as an industry, right? You can't ignore that Nixon is an acclaimed artist. His work has been collected by the Met, by the MoMA, by the National Gallery of Art. And so in an industry that works on favors and networks, like so many industries do, for young art students to break into a gallery in a museum scene young art students who want to break into these scenes, they can face tremendous pressure when they're sort of in a tricky situation with someone whom they perceive as a gatekeeper, with someone whom they perceive as having power to grant them access to the world of fine art that they want to break into.
This is a beginning of a conversation and an interesting story for you to be covering in these times. WBUR Arts reporter Maria Garcia, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. The novelist Richard Powers is the kind of writer who sees the interlocking details of almost everything. He writes at times from this view on high, literally talking to readers from the tallest redwood and from as deep a place and as microscopic as the inside of a leaf spore or wherever human curiosity and misery and desire live inside of us. Powers began writing his very first novel while living in Boston. His new book, The Overstory, is his 12th, and trees and people take turns as the story's protagonists. He weaves together 9 human characters, among them Nicholas Hoel, whose Norwegian ancestors plant a chestnut tree that grows strong far from its native soil out on an Iowan farm. There's Mimi Ma, whose immigrant Chinese father invests too much heart in a mulberry tree, and Neely Mehta, a young coding prodigy growing up in California who, as an adolescent, he looks for solace climbing up an ancient Spanish oak. The novel has a complex structure.
The book itself is structured as an enormous tree that you begin the book reading these 8 seemingly independent short stories that have nothing in common except this sense that each has been troubled by a tree. Each of these characters has been forced to reexamine who they are or where they come from because of some anxious relationship to things that aren't human, in particular a particular species.
And
of
you
tree.
Call them in the structure of the book, you call them the roots.
That's right.
On purpose.
The first portion of the book is roots. We have these separate characters who are separated and independent and, in a way, underground. It's the backstory of the main thrust of the novel. And in the second part of the book, they grow together into a trunk. And this story, 5 of the 9 characters do actually meet up in time and space and join forces in an attempt in the 1990s in the Pacific Northwest to save the last 3 to 5% of old growth uncut forests. The first character that we meet in this extremely condensed family saga that unfolds like a fast action movie in its own right is Jürgen Hoel, who comes over just before the Civil War, works briefly in the shipyards of Brooklyn, falls in love and marries an Irish immigrant, and brings her out to Homestead in Iowa, and also brings, by accident, a handful of chestnuts in his coat pocket, which they plant, and as they begin to raise this increasingly sprawling family, he does plant this unexpected legacy, and one of the trees survives.
So all of these characters, they develop over the course of their lives. They struggle. Each of them has an incredible loss, not just the death of a someone in their family, but a tragic death. Mm. And that tragic death sends them off into the next part of their life in some way. It always does, inevitably, for any of us.
Right.
You know, in a way, you know, if a tree falls in the forest and it lands and it stays there and no one's cleaning it up,
right,
it's fodder. It's becoming, you know, nutrient. It's becoming, you know, a place to hide for some animal life. What is this you're trying to do here with these tragic deaths that happen? And I don't want to give anything away. And linking it, again, the interweaving into a natural life, a science life, a life of biology.
Right. If it isn't a literal death, it's some kind of catastrophe that transfers the character from a safe place into an uncertain one. And it's that almost mythic journey into the underworld that they all have to come back out from. You know, we live with the illusion of safety. And that safety makes us blind to everything else. It makes us think that meaning is a purely personal thing and that all we need to do is take care and prosper and somehow figure out how to get out of this place alive, and we're not going to do it. And the realization that we're not going to do it, I think, is the kind of bond of blood that unites these characters in A Common Cause in the second part of the book.
So your book is bound to be embraced by those activists who are and did try to save was the spotted owl versus the families who were supported by the timber industry, right? So this is a story that's going to play out at other times in real life, not only in your narrative. Your book is going to be called an environmentalist's novel. How do you feel about that?
I'm okay with that. When you think about the variety of ways of telling a story, what makes a good conflict, what makes a good dramatic showdown, it seems to me that there are actually three kinds of crisis or confrontation that we can write about. We can write about an individual person whose values are conflicted. A person who wants one thing but finds that in the wanting they have to pay a price that they may or may not be comfortable for. We can call that a psychological novel. Then there's a second order of conflict, which is one person's values are at odd with another person's values, or one group of people hold something dear that another group does not. And that would be a social novel or a political novel. Literary fiction is very, very good at both of those, and we've become super adept at both reading and writing those kinds of stories. The third kind of conflict, which actually infuses all of literature for most of its history, but has dropped out of the story in recent times, perhaps for as long as a century, is this notion of the conflict between human beings and the not human. How do we accommodate and come to terms with an entire world that wants other things than we do? That's a different kind of drama. If you call the first political or psychological, the second political or social, I'm comfortable calling the third environmental, although the term comes with baggage.
Right, right. Which is what happens with anything that you put out in the world. Somebody's going to grab it and make it. They're going to take their baggage and connect
it. That's right. Right. There is no term.
But this is a particular. You've taken a chance because you write from a place of literature. Your other work has been it's been about music, and it's been about the digital life, and it's been about many different things. And much of that is also in the story.
There are psychological components and social components.
Yes, yep. and change, inevitable change. And there was one beautiful part where where Nile Mehta says, or you write maybe, and he's a youngster at this point. His parents still refer to California as the Golden State.
Right.
And it's just before it becomes, the word Silicon comes up. And we're talking about Silicon Valley, where so much has developed, and we have characters in here who were, another character. Her father developed the precursor or the cell phone, right?
That's right.
This family, the Mehta family, is in the virtual world. So we're not just in the trees here, and we're certainly not out in Iowa or in Oregon only. We are living a very modern life in this book in the 90s.
That's right.
A little before all the social media that's cropped up. It's just beginning.
That's right.
God, that would have changed the whole storyline, right, if there was Twitter
and right. Well, it, Facebook. It emerges as an important component right at the end of the book.
Right.
But you're describing exactly the trajectory that makes this a book about human beings looking for home and somehow getting onto this trajectory where they think they've defeated the world, they think that they've mastered and had dominion and subdued the earth, and they're migrating out into these other places, into these virtual digital proxy places, and are now being called back, are now hearing the world resist the human attempt to turn it into a different place. Interestingly, I should interject a couple of things. One, that Nile's Silicon Valley, you learn in the course of this book, was previously the Valley of Heart's Delight. Mm. There was nothing in the Central Peninsula in that area, which is now Google HQ, Apple HQ, Intel, Facebook, you name it. Mm-hmm. Used to be fruit orchards. It used to be trees as far as the eye can see.
I want to also ask you to, would you read this passage that's That's really a conversation with a tree.
In this passage, the artist Nicholas Houle is lying in a sleeping bag in the morning in the boreal north prior to going back to work on a large-scale land art project that becomes the final image of the book. And he's looking up at a stand of spruces that are blowing in the breeze, and he suddenly has this sense of the tips of these trees being enormous writing implements that are somehow tracing out words against the sky. But the spruces pour out messages in media of their own invention. They speak through their needles, trunks, and roots. They record in their own bodies the history of every crisis they've lived through. The man in the tent lies bathed in signals hundreds of millions of years older than his crude senses. And still, he can read them. The five white spruces sign the blue air. They write, light and water and a little crushed stone demand long answers. Nearby lodgepoles and jack pines demur. Long answers need long time, and long time is exactly what's vanishing. The black spruces down the drumlin put it bluntly. Warm is feeding on warm. The permafrost is belching. The cycle speeds up. Farther south, broadleaves agree. Noisy aspens and remnant birches. Forests of cottonwood and poplars take up the chorus. The world is turning into a new thing. The man rolls over onto his back, face to face with the morning sky. The messages swarm him. Even here, homeless, he thinks, nothing will be the same. The spruces answer, nothing has ever been the same. We're all doomed, the man thinks. We have always been doomed. But things are different this time. Yes, you are here.
That's Richard Powers reading from his new novel, The Overstory. You know, I don't know that everybody walks around saying we are desperate for answers. I walk around saying we are desperate for answers.
I think many, many people do, but I don't think they articulate it either out loud to themselves or to their friends. I really believe that the great majority of us are suffering from what psychologists call species loneliness, not loneliness for other human beings. We're lonely because we've talked ourselves into believing we're the only game in town. We're the only interesting thing going on. And that's why we're, you know, that's why we look at Facebook 158 times a day. But it feeds that hunger for something that's not us, can't be fed by us. And it turns into this saltwater addiction where we're getting thirstier the more we drink.
Right. But are you in your writing this kind of pointing to the human species as, okay, folks, you're taking this down. While yourself included,
yes,
are living on this planet, and we're reading books and we're publishing books and we're sitting at a wood table, by the way, and there's wood floor
yes.
under our feet, and the building's got
framed
lots of wood
out.
In it.
Yep.
I looked at every tree driving in here this morning in my car, you know, with the fossil fuel and all that. We are the source of the destruction as well as the source of living on this planet and loving it and taking care of it and being a species that evolves.
Beautifully so, put. It's a book that's saying, look, this solution, you know, this thing that trees do, getting up on a woody trunk and sticking out your solar cells and turning the sun into food and into everything there is, it's been around for a long time. It has gone through, it was invented many times independently by natural selection. It has gone through mass extinctions, right? It's a pretty good thing to put your money on. The question is whether we're going to come through on the other end. And that the answer to that question depends on tapping into our own magnificence, our own ability to see and think and project and model and understand, to tell stories and to hear stories.
As a writer, you've been doing this in other books where you sort of erase the chasm between music and technology, or a Bach cantata, as a friend of mine wrote to me about some of the books she's read of yours, and an airplane, and a bird, and a brain injury. She is a philosophy professor, once a radio producer, by the way, and she writes that at the end of reading your other books that she feels both a sublime sense of elation and terror, and that, you know, maybe she's just, by reading something that you've written where you've woven all these things together, shown us a little bit, or maybe the entirety of the meaning of life. That's her take. And it is breathtaking to travel so fast in these people's lives in the story, and in the lives of these forests too. They're much older than all of us.
I deeply appreciate what your friend says, and in fact, it was echoed by an early reviewer of the book who said something like, "I've never read a book so relentlessly bleak and yet so endlessly hopeful." What I'm trying to do in this book and in the previous books is to move meaning outside, to get rid of this idea that it's something that we have to create for ourselves privately, and to say, no, look, it's out there. It's going crazy. It's connected in a million ways, and you're there. You're in it. You just have to stand still and see.
Richard Powers, I want to thank you so much for coming in and giving us just a glimpse into all of this in the Overstory.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
That is novelist Richard Powers, the winner of the National Book Award and a MacArthur Fellow, and his new book is called The Overstory. And that is our show for today and this week, produced by a mob of great colleagues. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jill Kaufman. Have a great weekend.